Check, 1, 2. 1, 2, check. Oh, that looks beautiful. Let's go with it. From the studios of Wavefront Audio Visual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 93 of Little Brother for the 16th of July, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. There has been, for a long time now, a national number that you can call for help with mental health crises and suicide prevention. I'd give it to you, but hell if I can remember it. Doesn't matter, though, because it's just changed. Effective now, people in need of mental health assistance can pick up a phone and dial 988 to get connected. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said about this, quote, "If you are willing to turn to someone in your moment of crisis, 988 will be there. 988 won't be a busy signal, and 988 won't put you on hold. You will get help." It surprised me to hear that this was only just now happening, but at the start of this week, all of the toll bridges into New York City are no longer accepting cash. Just like with the thruway as a whole, when you go to cross one of these bridges, an RFID reader will attempt to read an EasyPass or compatible transponder on your car, and failing that, an ALPR will capture your license plate number for billing purposes. While this does raise the specter of tracking, there really are bigger fish to fry, as EasyPass transponders and license plates get read by all manner of devices that have nothing to do with tolling, and don't usually make it known that they're doing so. Tracking for billing purposes, however, that's all right, that's completely legitimate. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, has published a set of standards for strong post-quantum encryption. Current encryption systems rely on the difficulty of reversing certain mathematical operations. Quantum computing technology brings the promise of being able to solve such problems quickly without the need for much parallel processing. One of the four new standards, called Crystals-Kyber, is used for key exchange and would be a replacement for the venerable Diffie-Hellman standard. The other three, called Crystals-Dilithium, isn't that cute, Falcom, and Sphinx Plus, are for digitally signing content. Wireless unlock is a common feature on contemporary cars. It's a simple enough idea. You push a button, your key fob sends a signal to the car unlocks. The problem, of course, is that someone else can send the same signal, and your car will open for that also. A fix for this is to use rolling codes, where the key fob never uses the same code twice, or at least not for a good, long time. If the car receives the same code again, it ignores it. Well, security researchers, including one that I know personally, have discovered that Honda have botched this in some models between model years 2012 and 2022, and that a simple capture and replay of the key fob's signal is all it takes. With the proliferation of software-defined radios, this is now altogether too easy to do. By the way, if you have a radio that you can tune to such frequencies as those around 433 and 315 megahertz in a suburban or an urban environment, you will hear all kinds of digital traffic from remote-controlled devices in your area. Pluton is a security system devised by Microsoft that's part of the Azure Sphere. It implements in hardware things like cryptographic engines, random number generators, key generators, and cryptographic operations. All good stuff, right? It helps to keep your computer safe, kind of like a trusted platform module. The problem is, it comes with the potential, like the TPM, to keep you from installing what you want on your hardware that you ostensibly own. Most of the time this doesn't happen, but if you bought a Lenovo Z13 or Z16 with intentions of running Linux, tough luck. No Linux for you. The Pluton processor on these machines does not authorize it. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week? The pwn this week is Professional Finance Company. PFC is in the debt collection business, specifically medical debt. Apparently, back in February or so, they noticed and halted a ransomware attack. Of course, the problem with ransomware attacks, as I've mentioned many times before, is that the business model is two-pronged. By the time they are encrypting your data, they've already exfiltrated a whole bunch of it for blackmail or for sale if you refuse to pay the ransom. This case was no different. Data at risk here consists of names, addresses, social security numbers, and health records. It's like a scam ops starter pack. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says that about 1.9 million individuals, patients of over 650 medical facilities, were affected by this breach, making it the biggest breach involving medical data in U.S. history. 3 years ago, another similar business declared bankruptcy after and presumably because of exactly such a breach. On January 15, 1990, AT&T's long-distance telephone switching network crashed. This was a strange, dire, huge event. 60,000 people lost their telephone service completely. During the 9 long hours of frantic effort that it took to restore service, some 70 million telephone calls went uncompleted. That's the opening of Bruce Sterling's book, The Hacker Crackdown, published in 1992. Well worth a read, by the way, if you haven't, and it is available online for free legitimately. So if you haven't read it, shame on you. I first read it in 1994, and I'm going to be quoting it heavily in this piece because it had an excellent history of that event. I'm doing this because I got a message from one of my listeners who wanted to know what event I was talking about in the last episode when I was comparing it to the Rogers outage. For the benefit of the younger listeners, I want to take a quick sidebar and talk about how telephones worked in the early 1990s. Most telephones were wired. There were cell phones in 1990, but they were very expensive to use. So most people just used a landline phone. That you could get a cordless phone, of course, that through the magic of FM radio and ISM spectrum would let you wander around your house untethered, and it would allow any neighbor with a scanner to listen in. Don't ask me how I know that. You needed two telephone companies to run a landline phone. One company provided the basic service. With that, you could make calls to a very small area without costing a whole lot, or to a larger territory called a Local Access Transport Area, or LATA, for a price that looks like highway robbery today. At home, my service was provided by a company called New York Telephone, which, after a few mergers, is now Verizon. The other company provided what was called long-distance service. If you dialed a phone number outside of your LATA, the local company would pass the call off to your long-distance provider. AT&T was the largest long-distance provider at the time, thanks to them being the default choice for most local telephone companies. On top of that, they also provided local service in some areas. You could choose another carrier, such as MCI or Sprint or some others, but AT&T was the default, and that made them the biggest. And yes, you would actually get two phone bills. The internet existed. However, most people had no idea of this fact at the time, including me. As a college freshman in 1990, I'd had my first experience of networked email only a few months prior, using a network called BitNet. The web? Don't make me laugh. Dial-up could be used to send data over phone lines, but usually not in a networked manner, and certainly not typically through the internet. More often, data was done by having your computer call another computer in your area where you might find message boards and file repositories. We called those BBSs. So data was no different than a voice call from the phone company's perspective, and voice calls were how things got done. Now the stage is set. Let's continue from some of Sterling's history on the subject. He writes, "Under conditions of sharp commercial competition, a crash like that of January 15, 1990 was a major embarrassment to AT&T. It was a direct blow against their much-treasured reputation for reliability. Within days of the crash, AT&T's chief executive officer, Bob Allen, officially apologized in terms of deeply pained humility. Quote, AT&T had a major service disruption last Monday. We didn't live up to our own standards of quality, and we didn't live up to yours. It's as simple as that. And that's not acceptable to us, or to you. We understand how much people have come to depend upon AT&T service, so our AT&T Bell Laboratory scientists and our network engineers are doing everything possible to guard against a recurrence. We know there's no way to make up for the inconvenience that this problem may have caused you." Mr. Allen's open letter to customers was printed in lavish ads all over the country. In the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Philadelphia Inquirer, San Francisco Chronicle Inquirer, Boston Globe, Dallas Morning News, Detroit Free News, Washington Post, Houston Chronicle, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Minneapolis Star Tribune, St. Paul Pioneer Press, Dispatch, Seattle Time-Post Intelligencer, Tacoma News Tribune, Miami Herald, Pittsburgh Press, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Denver Post, Phoenix Republic-Gazette, and Tampa Tribune. In another press release, AT&T went to some pains to suggest that this software glitch might have happened just as easily to MCI, although in fact it hadn't. MCI's switching software was quite different from AT&T's, although not necessarily any safer. AT&T also announced their plans to offer a rebate of service on Valentine's Day to make up for the lost service during the crash. All right, this is me again. As it turns out, that statement about how this could have happened just as easily to MCI or to Sprint or anyone else, that was, shall we say, slightly economical with the truth. You see, there wasn't a software vendor out there making software for phone companies to purchase, nor a software vendor making the hardware for it to run on. All right, that's not quite true, but the thing of it is, these companies were the vendors. This was their own software running on their own hardware. AT&T, MCI, and Sprint were bitter rivals. The machinery that they each used was a jealously guarded trade secret, as was the software that ran on it. Accusations about corporate espionage and sabotage, criminal intent, and other things quickly cropped up and spread like wildfire. Then another set of theories popped up about us, hackers. Supposedly, we got in and broke it. We were viewed with deep suspicion at the time. Even though our motives for what we did were made clear, they were always viewed with suspicion. Breaking the national telephone system doesn't fit in with our motives, but that didn't stop the efforts to pin this on our community. Sterling writes, "Publicity served the interest of the telco's friends in law enforcement. Public officials, including law enforcement officials, thrive by attracting favorable public interest. A brilliant prosecution in a matter of vital public interest can make the career of a prosecuting attorney, and for a police officer, good publicity opens the purses of the legislature. It may bring a citation, a promotion, or at least a rise in the status and respect of one's peers. But to have both publicity and secrecy is to have one's cake and to eat it too. In the months to come, this impossible act was to cause great pain to the agents of the crackdown, but early on it seemed possible, maybe even likely, that the crackdown could successfully combine the best of both worlds. The arrest of hackers would be heavily publicized. The actual deeds of the hackers, what were technically hard to explain and also a security risk, would be left decently obscured. The threat hackers posed would be heavily trumpeted. The likelihood of their actually committing such fearsome crimes would be left to the public's imagination. The spread of the computer underground and its growing technical sophistication would be heavily promoted. The actual hackers themselves, mostly bespectacled middle-class white suburban teenagers, would be denied any personal publicity. It does not seem to have occurred to any telco official that the hackers accused would demand a day in court, that journalists would smile upon the hackers as good copy, that wealthy high-tech entrepreneurs would offer moral and financial support to crackdown victims, that constitutional lawyers would show up with briefcases in hand, frowning mightily. This possibility does not seem to have ever entered the game plan. All right. That brings us to a brief discussion of how telephone switches work and what they do. We'd reached a point in time where the vast majority of telephone switching was electronic. A good chunk of it was still analog, but I remember in particular being able to pick up a phone and call a neighbor, having the phone call be stunningly sharp and clear because there wasn't anything choking down the passband of the call. It had a very full frequency response, save for some of the bass being shaved off. It stayed that way right up until the start in 1995 when the switch in my hometown was upgraded to a digital one, and then all the phone calls had about the same pretty good, but not quite as nice, sound quality. In that analog period, it didn't sound that clear when you called out of the area, but that was to be expected. And it did sound clear enough. After the cutover, all the phone calls sounded about the same quality. But now, it was being handled by chips and software, which brings us back to Sterling. There are, however, quite serious drawbacks to the use of computer chips. When they do break down, it is a daunting challenge to figure out what the heck went wrong with them. A broken cord board generally had a problem with it that was big enough to see. A broken chip has invisible, microscopic faults, and the faults in bad software can be so subtle as to be practically theological. If you want a mechanical system to do something new, then you must travel to where it is and pull pieces out of it and wire in new pieces. This costs money. However, if you want a chip to do something new, all you have to do is change its software, which is easy, fast, and dirt cheap. You don't even have to see the chip to change its program. And even if you did see the chip, it wouldn't look like much. A chip with program X doesn't look one whit different from a chip with program Y. With the proper codes and sequences, and access from specialized phone lines, you could change the electronic switching systems all over America from anywhere you please. Unfortunately, computers are also stupid. Unlike human beings, computers possess the truly profound stupidity of the inanimate. Some software is bad and buggy. Some is robust, even quote-unquote bulletproof. The best software is that which has been tested by thousands of users under thousands of different conditions over years. It's then known as stable. This does not mean that the software is now flawless and free of bugs. It generally means that there are plenty of bugs in it, but the bugs are well identified and fairly well understood. There is simply no way to assure that software is free of flaws. Though software is mathematical in nature, it cannot be proven like a mathematical theorem. Software is more like language, with inherent ambiguities, with different definitions, different assumptions, different levels of meaning that can conflict. Human beings can manage, more or less, with human language because we can get the gist of it. Computers, despite years of effort in artificial intelligence, have proven spectacularly bad in catching the gist of anything at all. The tiniest bit of semantic grit may still bring the mightiest computer tumbling down. One of the most hazardous things that you can do to a computer program is try to improve it, to try to make it safer. I'd argue, actually, it's probably more to make it better, but software patches represent new, untried, unstable software, which is, by definition, riskier. The modern telephone system has come to depend utterly and irretrievably upon software, and the system crash of January 15, 1990 was caused by an improvement in the software, or rather, an attempted improvement. As it happened, the problem itself took this form. A piece of telco software had been written in the C language, a standard language of the telco field. Within the C software was a long do-while construct. The do-while construct contained a switch statement. The switch statement contained an if clause. The if clause contained a break, and the break was supposed to break the if clause. Instead, it broke the switch statement. That was the subtle, abstract, cyberspatial seed of the problem. This is how the problem manifested itself from the realm of programming into the realm of real life. Okay. The software involved was part of AT&T's flagship product, Switching System 7. It was brand new in December of 1989, and it had a new feature that was supposed to improve its reliability by making it faster for a failed switch to return to service. When a switch failed in a way that it needed a reboot, it'd send out a message to all of its adjacent switches telling them that it's going down. It would then reboot, and then it would send its neighbors a message that it had returned to service. Very sensible, right? All of this took 6 seconds on the 4ESS switching hardware. Pretty impressive compared to how long it takes to boot up a computer these days, especially a server, don't you think? Now, here's where the flaw comes in. If a switch received two incoming calls within 10 milliseconds of each other, and also got one of those back-in-service messages, the back-in-service message would get corrupted. The switch would recognize the corruption problem as something that it could cure with a reboot, which it would then go do. When that switch came back, it would blast a back-in-service message to all of its neighbors, and so on. Now, as you might imagine, if a switch is down, its traffic has to go elsewhere, which increases the likelihood of two incoming calls hitting a given switch within 10 milliseconds of each other. That brings us to January 15th, 1990. A switch in Brooklyn detected a problem. It decided to reboot itself. It shed its load into its neighbors, and it sent the out-of-service messages. Like clockwork, 6 seconds later, it came back in service and announced its triumphant return, only to knock down some of its neighbors in the process. So let's hear this with one last excerpt from Sterling. But the switch had been programmed to monitor itself constantly for any possible damage to its data. When the switch perceived that its data had been somehow garbled, then it too would go down for swift repairs to its software. It would signal its fellow switches not to send any more work. It would go into the fault recovery mode for 4 to 6 seconds, and then the switch would be fine again, and it would send out its OK, ready for work signal. However, the OK ready for work signal was the very thing that caused the switch to go down in the first place, and all the System 7 switches had the same flaw in their status map software. As soon as they stopped to make the bookkeeping note that their fellow switch was OK, then they too would become vulnerable to the slight chance that two phone calls would hit them within a hundredth of a second. At approximately 2:25 p.m., Eastern Time on Monday, January 15th, one of AT&T's 4ESS toll switching systems in New York City had an actual, legitimate minor problem. It went into fault recovery routines and announced, "I'm going down," and then announced, "I'm back, I'm okay," and this cheery message then blasted throughout the network to many of its fellow 4ESS switches. Many of the switches, at first, completely escaped trouble, but these lucky switches were not hit by the coincidence of two phone calls within a hundredth of a second. Their software did not fail at first. But three switches, one in Atlanta, one in St. Louis, and one in Detroit, were not so lucky, and they were caught with their hands full. And they went down, and they came back up almost immediately, and they too began to broadcast the lethal message that they too were okay, activating the lurking software bug in yet other switches. It only took 4 seconds for a switch to get well. There was no physical damage of any kind to the switches. After all, physically, they were working perfectly. This situation was only a software problem. But the 4ESS switches were leaping up and down every 4 to 6 seconds in a virulent, spreading wave all over America. In utter manic mechanical stupidity, they kept knocking one another down with their contagious "I'm okay" messages. It took about 10 minutes for the chain reaction to cripple the network, and even then, switches would periodically luck out and manage to resume their normal work. Many calls, millions of them, were managing to get through, but millions weren't. And that, my dear listeners, is what happened to AT&T in 1990. As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. The fail of the week this week is ERCOT. I'm honestly surprised that I haven't featured these guys before. ERCOT is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. So, quick background. There are basically three power grids in the continental U.S., the Eastern Interconnection, the Western Interconnection, and the Texas Interconnection. Texas is separate for entirely political reasons. By not having any connections outside of the state, they're not subject to federal rules on how to operate a power grid. This is unfortunate for two reasons. First, those rules ensure a certain minimal level of reliability, which Texas has demonstrated that they lack. And secondly, if Texas runs short on power, they can't import any from elsewhere, like literally every other state in the main 48 can do. So the reason I'm giving them a fail this week is that they've been running short on power. They've been pleading with Texans to conserve power, and eventually had to order rolling blackouts. One amusing side effect reported in the New York Post concerned Houston's ABC TV affiliate, Channel 13, where the studio lights went out for several seconds in the middle of the evening weather forecast on Thursday night. Broadcasting equipment continued to operate on UPS power for the few seconds until the generator kicked in. But, you know, you do you, Texas. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Funkaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Azriel, Michael Bronstein, Free Scholar Family Tree, Knight Rider 007, Ed, and Snackness for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asara Had. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Easy Pass or a compatible transponder mail or for sale if you refuse to play the ransom. Without costing a whole lot or to a larger territory. With that, you can make calls to a very small area without crossing a whole lot or to a larger territory called a territory. Damn it. I did say that word right. I did that one more time. There's the Eastern Interconnection. Snackness for Snorri leads. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a wrap.